What did the first story sound like? Was it someone just telling about their day in an embellished way? Or were they making up epics about gods and monsters? Or maybe it was a combination of both, back when the unexplainable was easily attributed to supernatural beings. No matter what, there must have been a first storyteller who captivated their audiences and invented the art. Today, we're talking about stories. This is the Asymptote Podcast. Чебурашка, квартира, зеркало, отопление, окно. Before we begin, the deadline of our translation contest, December 15th, is approaching. The winner will receive $1,000. Also, our upcoming one-day donation drive on Giving Tuesday, December 1st, is coming up, where we ask our supporters to keep us in mind and toss us some coin. Every little bit will go a long way towards supporting the many projects we have brewing, like our educational arm, anniversary events, our new fortnightly airmail, and a book club. All right, let's get started. If I had to live in a time before civilization, I wouldn't want to be a hunter or a warrior. I'd want to be a storyteller. Why? Well, I'm not very good at hunting or warring, but the storyteller got it pretty good. They got the best spot at the campfire, the best cut of meat, and maybe the first mug of some prehistoric ale. Today, we still tell stories around a campfire, but we also have more complex ways of telling them. In this episode of the Asymptote Podcast, we're going to look at two radically different ways of telling a story. Our first segment takes us to Poland, where Beatrice brings us interviews with Polish reporters discussing the craft of telling a story. I'll let her take it from here.
Creative writing programs are not usually popular in Poland. But 5 years ago, Wojciech Tochman, Paweł Guzliński, and Mariusz Szczygiel founded the Institute of Reportage in Warsaw, where they teach by example of Hannah Kroll and Ryszard Kapuściński. They publish their own books, sponsor events, and run a genre-specific bookshop so packed with college students, reportage looks like the hippest thing you can do in Poland. For example, right now, on the Polish bestseller list is a 2,848-page anthology of just 20th-century Polish reportage, edited by Mariusz Szczygiel, who's one of the founders of the Institute. The three-volume set goes for a pricey 229 zlotys, which is about one-fifth of a typical month's rent in Poland, but they say that reportage, next to osypek, dill pickles, and poetry, is the best we have. Antonia Lloyd-Jones is an award-winning translator of Polish literature and a mentor at the British Center for Literary Translation. But for me, she's also been a guide. It was through her that I found the work of Mariusz Szczygiel and followed that thread to other contemporary writers that she translated, like Jacek Hugo Bader, Wojciech Tochman, or Philip Springer, whom she recommended. I'm Beatrice Migazowicz, and for this podcast, I had a chance to sit down at the Konrad Festival in Krakow with Antonia and Mariusz to talk about what Polish reportage means to them. We'll start with Antonia by talking about the challenges of translating reportage and how it's different from the fiction she works on. Mariusz will talk about what he learned from Kroll and Kapuściński about the sentence, the use of first person, and what he is teaching his students. And we'll close by looking at the anthology of Polish essay and reportage that Antonia is putting together. How does reportage differ from the fiction you translate?
Fiction is inevitably self-referential, and the reason for that is partly that Polish writers didn't have the chance in the communist era to process everything that had happened to this country during the war and in the communist era fully. And of course, in a country that has freedom of speech, all these things happen naturally, and we can come to terms with traumas through literature and other forms of open debate. Whereas in this country, although there was some fantastic literature written during the communist era, a lot of which hasn't been translated and should be, there's a whole backlog of wonderful stuff. Just that full understanding of what had happened to this country in the war and the relationships between various different groupings in this country couldn't really be fully aired. And I think since 1989, Polish literature has still been coming to terms with the experience of the country itself and even the most recent changes. So it's inevitable that it has to keep being self-referential and processing its experience. And that sometimes means that the fiction has a harder time travelling abroad. The reportage is in a different category. So, for instance, I came to it, I suppose, originally through Kapuscinski, because, of course, I'd read Kapuscinski in translation, even when I was, before I knew Polish particularly well. And I've always been aware of his work and admired it massively.
What attracts you to Polish nonfiction or reportage?
I've always loved nonfiction. There's some incredibly good travel writers. For instance, Colin Thubron, I think, is a very great writer. He's also a novelist, but his travel books are just knockout. And then we have also news reporters who write books about what's happening in particular countries, and sometimes they are BBC correspondents or people who have some inside knowledge on the ground of what's happening in particular around particular events, wars or incidents that are happening in our lifetime. But on the whole, those books put the writer at the centre, and you see things from that writer's point of view, and the writer exists very much and is sort of holding your hand all the way through. Whereas what's different about Polish reportage is that it approaches its topics from a different angle. One is that it's very economical with the way it uses words, and I find a great distinction between a lot of the Polish fiction I read compared with a lot of the non-fiction is that the non-fiction writers know what to leave out. It's not particularly analytical. The author stands back and lets his subjects and stories do the talking and doesn't lead the reader, but often leaves the reader to read between the lines and to draw his own conclusions. And I would say that Mariusz Szczygieł is absolutely brilliant at that. And it makes him difficult to translate. But, well, I always compare Mariusz's writing, and he's very much a kind of heir to Hannah Krall in the way he writes. I compare his writing to the kind of modern painting that relies on somebody coming along and just doing three masterful strokes of a brush. And there's something that just makes everybody stop and stare. And you think, how on earth did they do that? It looks so simple, but it just speaks volumes. And he can do that with language. And that makes him very difficult to translate, because sometimes, in order to try to convey all that, everything that's being said in Polish in a few apparently simple sentences, you find yourself putting down quite a screed, and then I always have to strip it back and just keep that lightness of touch.
What is an important quality for you in a text?
I'm always listening to the text. I think a great deal is achieved by a writer when his work reads well aloud. And I read everything aloud. I don't have a television, I listen to the radio. And I think it's very, very important to listen to the cadence of a piece of writing and the flow of it. Because, and then sometimes it might be syncopated, it might suddenly make you stop and sit up. And as a translator, you've got to listen to that, because all of that is what makes really good writing.
I always read my work out loud. That's the school of Hannah Krall.
That's Mariusz Szczygieł.
I read out loud because then I hear when the meter is off. Sometimes the sentences are too long and overloaded with words. It's like a sack that you fill with garbage and everything flies out of it. And that you have to hear. I really like synthesis. That you can contain everything in one sentence. When in the Polish Republic of the People during Communist Poland, very many Poles had problems with teeth. They had no teeth. Or they didn't have all their teeth, for example. It was a big problem, and it wasn't that they didn't have money for dentists. We know that Americans value good teeth. The identity of an American starts with their teeth, we say here in Europe. When I lived in a capitalist country after the fall of communism in 1990, I worked in a factory that was established by a Polish American, Cultus International. He was the richest Pole that lived in America. He ran a TV factory, and in that factory of televisions, everything was different than during communism. The interiors looked a lot better. People wore uniforms and wore different clothes. The walls were painted in bright colors. And in Poland, they were depressing shades, gray colors. There were carpets on the floor in that factory. And before, there had only been concrete. So it was ice there. It was pretty there. And I was talking to the workers at the factory when I heard what one of the managers said to the workers. "Listen, here in our factory, it's so nice, so pretty, that you have to get those teeth put in." That, to me, was the synthesis of modern times, the synthesis of capitalism. "Listen, Jadwiga, Jadzia, here on the production line, it's so nice that you have to get those teeth put in." And that was the root of my text. That synthesis encapsulates the ambitions, capitalism, the desire for a better life, and that shows the change of the system.
I always wanted to ask you, what does your research look like?
From my book, Make Yourself in Eden. There was a moment when I realized that my faith in God drained from me like from a broken dish, just like when you have a vase and that water runs off it, escapes. And slowly that faith in God escaped from me, and I stopped believing. I felt that it was a moment of fear for me. I started to worry. Will I feel at peace with this? Will I be scared? Will I not fear loneliness? How will I live without God, and will I not feel cold in my soul? And that was a realistic fear for me, and it occurred to me that I should ask the Czechs about that, because 80% of Czechs are atheists. I mean, it's a very secular country, the most secular country in Europe. And I know many happy Czechs, and I should ask them if one could be happy without God. And that's how that theme got started. When I finally arrive, I take all my notes and all my recordings and try to rewrite them, to write them over, and rewrite them on new pieces of paper, on large pieces of paper. And there are a lot of those pieces of paper like this, and I number each one and lay them out around me, and that's when I start to write. I never write from notes or from recordings. I have to have it rewritten, and when I rewrite it by hand, a lot of that information takes shape in my mind. And then I know what I have. And sometimes when I have a lot of these notebooks in which I take notes, or when I have those loose papers on which I transcribe a recording, I take inventory. I would have to show you at home. I write smaller themes, small sub-themes, and jot down on which page that is. And then I have a table of contents. I know how to order the text, and I know where to find the material, where I need to look for it. I pull out a page, and aha, aha, and I write it.
In the US, we call the search you describe an essay, an attempt. But in Poland, the term essay is typically referring to something else in form. Could you explain?
In Poland, because our culture was a culture of nobility, later there appeared a class of intelligentsia, especially in the 19th century, when Poles fought for independence. Came the intelligentsia, who with the help of literature, with the help of words, fought for Poland, for the independence of Poland, for Polish culture, for Polish literature. There appeared that class of intelligentsia that is typical to Poland and typical to Russia. In other countries, we would say it's the middle class, but here we had this class of intelligentsia up until the year 1989. That would be all the writers, journalists, publicists, cultural representatives. Bolesław Prus wrote chronicles for several decades, and they are those mediations typical of the intelligentsia. But events he wrote down in his books and in the chronicles, he wrote in that more sublimated way. And intelligentsia created a kind of essay that only focuses on reflections. A reportage writer would hold more to events. Kapuscinski always thought that a reportage writer should read 100 pages of others' texts for one's page of their own. To write one page of their own text, they need to read 100 pages of someone else's.
You have a very different relationship to the I in your writing. There's almost no first person in your work.
We say that when you're a young reporter, it's better not to reveal that I too soon, because you have to know how to do it. The I in Hannah Krall is very discreet. The I in Kapuscinski is more visible. You can see in those reportages that Kapuscinski thought he is 70 years old in some of his reportages. He's a great guy. I don't know how you would say it in English. Cool boy? We say in reportage that from Kapuscinski's eye, you can tell that it's a great guy. And in Tochman, for example, you can see that eye is very sensitive to his conversationalists and very cruel to his readers. Very many reporters in Poland were raised by Malgorzata Szenert. She was the director of the Jalu reportage, and most of the very good reportage writers are her students. Tochman, Hugo Bader, Lydia Astalowska, those and me are her students. And she didn't let us use the eye. She also didn't allow for our own reflections. We had to describe only what we saw. I write what I hear, I always called it, and I wrote what I heard. Until I was 40 years old, I was afraid to write something of myself, some sentence of my own, because Malgorzata Szenert didn't let us. She thought that we were too young.
When we talk about nonfiction writing in the US, especially in the essay, there's always a question of truth and its relationship to fact and literature. Some would even argue truthful words are not beautiful, or beautiful words are not truthful. Does this paradigm exist here? Does it frame the conversation in the same way? What's your relationship to truth, fact, and beauty?
It's possible to write truthfully and beautifully. It's possible to combine fact and beauty. The facts have to check out. It's incomprehensible that they would not check out. They have to be accurate. But now, what is a fact? For example, okay, tell me what's the color of your blouse. Exactly. And for me, it isn't. To me, it's the color of coffee with milk, or the color of rust. And I often, at author meetings, will point to, for example, some woman's blouse, and I'll most often choose the color I think is salmon, like the fish. And I ask different people, men and women, what color is the blouse? And very often that woman says, well, that's a burgundy. The man will say, no, it's red. Some other will say, no, that's maroon. And some other woman, no way, that's brick. And yet, some else will say wine. That's a fact that the blouse is some color is a fact, but what color? And now, who is right? They're all right. And no one will say that they're lying. Not a single one of them will say that they're lying. They'll argue, but how come that woman was in a red blouse for sure? No, that woman was in a blouse that was maroon. And what's a fact? Who is to establish this fact? But if we say and write as authors that the blouse was green, that's a lie. And that's something we should not do. But a reporter has a right to his own impressions of the fact. And the impressions of the fact are also facts for me. Fact is fact in a text, but fact and impression is a fact too. That's my math. I'll give you another example. But you will need to find the right equivalent in the English language for that tree. There is a plum tree, right? Plum, yes? But in Poland, there is another tree that has tiny yellow plums, and here we call it Mirabelka. About the Mirabelka, a while back I have Hannah Krall on a topic about the ghosts of the Warsaw Ghetto. There was a married couple that came to the TV station because I was once a talk show host. The married couple would constantly tell us that they had the ghosts of Jewish residents in their home, and Hannah Krall became interested in this, and she wrote a reportage piece about it. And when she was there in the yard, she saw that in the yard is a Mirabelka, that little plum tree. Looked at it as though it was no longer growing. No longer growing. Its roots were pulling above the ground, and part of the roots were underground, and the other showing above. It was hard to tell if it was growing or not growing. You could tell that it was unhappy. And now I told you a fact regarding that Mirabelka, which had some of its roots exposed. And now Hannah Krall could write, Mirabelka has half of its roots exposed. But then you have to add something to this. Explain. And Krall wrote this sentence, one and only. The Mirabelka tried to leave. Period. The Mirabelka tried to leave. Please tell me, is this a fact or not? Is this literature? Yes. It is. Yes. But is it literature a fact? Hannah Krall will say yes. And we in Poland will say yes. And that's the literature of fact and the Polish school of reportage. The Mirabelka tried to leave. It's poetry, even. Exactly. And that's our problem in Poland.
What are you working on now?
So I've been putting together, I was asked to put together an anthology of stories set in Warsaw. And this is actually, I found, a pretty difficult task because there are quite a lot of novels set in Warsaw, less stories, a lot of which have already been translated. So I wanted to try and find things that hadn't appeared in English before. I also wanted to pick things, I made myself a real straitjacket with this project because I wanted to pick things that, in a sense, as a set of stories in one book of a rather limited length, do portray some of the history of Warsaw, which is a city with a particularly complex history, which has changed nation, changed empires and been blown to bits and rebuilt and gone through all sorts of traumas. And what I've ended up with is a book that is half short stories and half reportage. And it's very, I find that interesting that that's how it has inevitably come out. And Hannah Krall is in there. And here's a wonderful example of her oblique way of telling a story. I wanted to have something in this book that was about Jewish life in Warsaw before the war and about the whole Jewish area. And her story is called The Presence. And it was actually based on a story that Mariusz Jigiel found when he was doing a television show about all sorts of public issues. In my little tiny way, by translating literature and now trying to help other translators to get started and kind of passing on the baton, I hope that that will contribute to people in Western countries not thinking of Polish or Central European literature as some sort of exotic thing that's a bit tricky, but as something they would just turn to as they would turn to a French book or a German book.
Thank you for listening.
Our second segment takes us to Denmark, and it's a series of poems from the collection Third Millennium Heart by Ursula Ankeyer Olsen, translated by Katrine. You may think that a poem is vague and metaphorical, but it's still a story, even if you're not quite sure what the story is. That's the beauty of it. Ursula Ankeyer Olsen is one of Denmark's most important contemporary poets. She won the prestigious literary award Monteprisen in 2013 for her poetry collection Third Millennium Heart, which you're about to hear. When Katrine was asked to translate Olsen's work into English, she was excited and terrified. Olsen plays around with Danish phrases, puns, and invents new words. However, as Katrine says, the most difficult part of translating her poetry is Olsen's strong use of voice. The speaker in Third Millennium Heart is an ambiguous character, abusive yet a victim, fiercely emotional yet icy and cynical. Scholar Ida Benke writes in her essay, The Body is Something Else, Posthumanism and Cyborg Hearts in the Works of Ursula Ankeyer Olsen. In Third Millennium Heart, an utterly monstrous character of the body is presented to us, a heart whose arteries and chambers lead us into complex architectural constructions and mythical castle facilities. From this hybrid body space, a terrifying female figure arises, spewing a long list of contradictory judgments and prophecies out over the Western world's perverted civilization and marketing mechanisms. The work is composed of several short, out-of-breath-like texts that aggressively branch out, pointing in wild and completely different directions. As a matter of fact, the ambiguity of this Third Millennium Heart character is so prevalent that any reading of its intentions could be disproved with an equally well-documented interpretation of the exact opposite statement. That's quite a review. Olsen's work shows how the poetic medium, particularly idioms, puns, and made-up words, can create a character who cannot exist in the real world, yet still feels real. Olsen is essentially writing a story that defies the very rules of story, but it works. Poetry can bend narrative to its breaking points, and hearing a story break is, well, kind of awesome. We're presenting you these poems in the original Danish and in English, so you can really hear the process of translation.
Når jeg ligger på ryggen og græder, løber tårerne via tindingen ind i øregangene. Når trykket bliver højt nok, vil væsken presses tilbage op i tårkanalen, og jeg kan ligge sådan, som et lukket kredsløb, lydløs jubel, springvand i flere tusind år. When I lie on my back and cry, tears run from my temples and into each ear canal. When the pressure is high enough, the fluid is pushed back into my tear ducts, and I can lie like this, a closed orbit, silent exhalation, fountain, for several thousand years. Jeg vil mere end bare jer. I vækker ikke drømme om sammensmeltning i mig. Jeg selv gør. Det, jeg kan blive svanger med, gør. Alt det, som et menneske kan blive svanger med, gør. Ud af båsen med jer. Jeg spænder jer for altings vogn. Jeg rider jer som en væksthund. Vi rider lige op i slottene, tårnene, spirene. I want more than just you. Nothing of you awakens my dreams of fusion. Your sperm does. What I can become pregnant with does. All that a human can become pregnant with does. Get out of the stalls. I will hitch you to everything's wagon. I will ride you like a bulldog of growth. We will ride straight up into castles, towers, spires. I drømmer om frihed. Det er enkelt. Befri jeres pikke i mig. I søger mit navn, det giver 20.000 tits, good tits og bad tits, 20.000, jeg vil være mere. You all dream of freedom, it's simple, liberate your cocks in me. You search my name and get 20.000 tits, good tits and bad tits, 20.000, I want to be more. Det dynamiske er kvindeligt og mandligt. Det mandlige og det kvindelige, jeg knupper disse to imod hinanden, indtil alting sker. Jeg tænker med babelskussen, med elfenbens hjernen, indtil jeg tænker med babels hjernen, med elfenbens pikken, og ingenting i mig vil forhindre dig i at gå derhen, hvor samfundet ikke er, og male dine længsler med red stråleglans. Du er mandlig, dynamisk, bevægelig, blød. Jeg er kvindelig, statisk, hård. Du er mandlig, stiv, statisk. Jeg er kvindelig, fleksibel, plastisk, dynamisk. Alt er muligt. dynamic is female and male. The female and the male, I rub these two against each other until everything happens. I think with Babel cunt, with ivory brain, until I think with Babel brain, with ivory cock, and nothing inside me will prevent you from going there, where society is not, and color your longings with red radiance. You are male, dynamic, movable, soft. I am female, static, hard. You are male, stiff, static. I am female, flexible, plastic, dynamic. Anything is possible. Den ene virkelighed bliver slagtet på den anden virkeligheds alter. Den anden virkelighed bliver slagtet på den tredjes alter. Den tredje bliver slagtet på den fjerdes, og mennesker, dyr, guder, arbejde, ensomhed, Babel og elfen strømmer fra hånd til mund, fra den enes hånd til den andens mund, den andens mund til den tredjes. Mine tjenere, mine usynlige tjenere, er som en hær. De tager min sjæl, skal blive som vand, skal gennemstrømme alt under udsyngelse af gloria. Alle virkeligheder skal hævnes, hver og en. One reality is slaughtered at another reality's altar. The other reality is slaughtered at the third reality's altar. The third reality is slaughtered at the fourth's. And humans, animals, gods, work, loneliness, Babel and ivory stream from hand to mouth, from one's hand to the other's mouth to the third's. My servants, my invisible servants are an army. They take my soul, must become water, must traverse everything while singing Gloria. All realities must be avenged, each and every one. Matriarkatet 1. Hvis markedet er en moder, så skal det malkes. Hvis individet er en pik, så skal det bruge kondom. Matriarkatet 2. Hvis en rig mand kan malkes, så er han en moder. Matriarkatet 3. Du kan fucke moder markedet, det hjælper ikke. Et hvert hul gror sammen igen. Matriarkatet 4. Både det dynamiske og det fleksible individ er spændt ud mellem Big Mother-staten og drømmen om det jomfruelige marked. Matriarkatet 5. Vælg mellem Big Mother-staten eller Big Mother's Darling Boy-staten. The Matriarchate 1. If the market is a mother, then it must be milked. If the individual is a cock, then it must use a condom. The Matriarchate 2. If a rich man can be milked, then he is a mother. The Matriarchate 3. You can fuck mother market, it won't help anything. Every hole grows back together. The Matriarchate 4. Both the dynamic and flexible individuals are stretched between a big mother state and the dream of a virgin market. The Matriarchate 5. Choose between a big mother state or a big mother's darling boy state. Med isen vendt mod øst sidder en mand på knæ og hænder, og over ham, med isen vendt mod øst, krummer sig en anden mand på knæ og hænder, og over ham, med isen vendt mod øst, krummer en tredje mand på knæ og hænder, og over, hen over ham, går den nye sol ned. Pate pointing east, a man sits on knees and hands, and above him, pate pointing east, another man curls on knees and hands, and above him, pate pointing east, a third man curls on knees and hands, and above him the new sun sets. Den planet er spindelvæv, som opstår, når jeg knubber mine fingre imod hinanden, og den planet er spindelvæv, som opstår, når alle knubber alles, er enstandet. Vi rækker hinanden planeter og spindelvæv af hensyn og ikke hensyn, koblet til større og større net af hensyn og ikke hensyn. Vi fanger fish, imens livet rider bort mellem fingrene, som kvinder, der rider mænd. The planet of spiderweb created when I rub my fingers against each other, and the planets of spiderweb created when everyone rubs everyone's are uniform. We hand each other planets and spiderwebs in caring and non-caring, tethered to larger and larger webs of caring and non-caring. We catch fish while life writes off between our fingers, like women writing men. Jeg giver det tredje årtusindes hjerte. Jeg sender det i kredsløb og får det tifold tilbage igen. Det vokser via Babels evnen. Tifold, tifold, tifold. Så meget kompliceret væsen. Jeg vil aldrig kunne få det ind igen. Det tårner sig op. Det vælter ud over livets bue, hvor det grundlægger mine tårne og byer. I give away my third millennium heart. I send it into orbit and get it back tenfold. It grows via the Babel effect. Tenfold, tenfold, tenfold. So much complicated being. I'll never be able to get it back in. It's towering up. It's pouring out over the vault of life, founding my towers and cities. Mit liv hænger i lange tråde ned fra himlen i et spindelapparat, som holder det på plads, oprejst i brystet. Når havene stiger i halsen, vil livets ophæng blive truet. Dommeren siger all rise, og den store blå retssal løfter sig og opsluger mennesker, dyr, guder eller hjerterne selv, komplicerede væsner. Hvis ikke jeg når at få organerne ud af brystkassen, kravlegården og sender dem i kredsløb. My life is hanging by long threads from the sky. A spindle apparatus that keeps it in place, in an upright position in my chest. When oceans rise in the throat, life's angering is threatened. The judge says all rise, and the big blue courtroom gets up and swallows. Humans, animals, gods, or even hearts, complicated beings. Unless I pull the organs out of my ribcage, playpen, and send them into orbit.
We'll never know what the first story ever told sounded like, but it was the start of something. The start of poetry, novels, films, newspapers, TV shows, and of course, podcasts. World literature isn't just about celebrating the geography of literature, but its variety as well. Thanks for listening. Asymptote's podcast was edited by Sally Decker. Our next episode comes out in December. We'll see you then.